As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, investing in local communities, economies, and a sustainable future. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Member SIPC. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
We're joined by Richard Attias. He's executive chairman of Richard Attias & Associates. But actually, Richard is much more than that. He's one of the most famous businessmen, PR gurus in France, if not in Europe. And the interview that I was looking forward to the most today. Richard, what did we find out yesterday? Is it that the polls are right? Is it that we still don't know how Macron is going to have enough support to govern? Or is it that your France is deeply changing? These are candidates that came out of nowhere.
First of all, I would say that the first lesson is that you have 41% of French people who supported two candidates who are ready to exit, to make, I would say, a big extreme decisions. And this is quite concerning, and we should not forget that. Before the win of Emmanuel Macron as running the first round, definitely we should not forget this 19%+ of Mélenchon and the 21%+ of Marine Le Pen. And this is quite concerning because this definitely is showing that you have so many people in France, like in many countries all over the world, who are very frustrated, who want a real change. The second message is that France are ready for a revolution. And by the way, this is the name of the program of Emmanuel Macron, but a positive revolution. And the third lesson is that, which was absolutely unusual and unexpected, is that the French people are ready to elect, potentially, a guy who more or less is coming from nowhere. And this was more an American dream, you know?
We didn't know him 2 years ago.
This is more the American dream DNA. And I didn't think, and many others didn't think, that this could happen one day in France.
But Richard, is this out of conviction, right? And if it is out of conviction, it means that he could muster enough support either independently in the legislatives or through a coalition. Or is it because none of the other candidates were palatable to a majority of people here?
No, I think the French people are fed up with the traditional political elite. And this was said for months, even for years. And they really wanted a change in the political landscape. And the French political party were not promoting enough the young generation of politicians. And suddenly you have a young man, 39 years old, coming from a private sector, who spent only 2 years in politics, who was pushed by two, three mentors to be recommended to François Hollande, to be a deputy secretary general of the Élysée, who took an amazing opportunity to become the Minister of Finance, of the economy, because his predecessor resigned, not because he was part of the government. So Emmanuel Macron has a fantastic star lighting in the sky, who is helping him, and he's also an opportunist, which is important to have when you right. want to be in politics.
But Richard, what does that guardian angel, as you suggest, that Macron has do for him in the legislatives? Because he can have a good plan for reforms. If he can't govern, then this country may be worse off in 5 years than it is now.
So this is a $1 million or euro question. In fact, is what will happen in the next 2 months. Because he will have to designate and to nominate a government. No choice. We have no clue about who will be the potential next prime minister. It could come from, the center. It could come from the private sector. Everything is possible because every day he's making some quite, interesting and surprising decisions. And he's now surrounded by people so diverse. Mm-hmm. Diversity is very important for Emmanuel Macron. Gender equality is important for Emmanuel Macron. So we don't really know who could be the next prime minister. But what will happen end of June when the, elections at the Congress, at the Parliament will happen? This is a big question mark, because maybe it will not reflect the results of the presidential election. In France, we elect a president. We don't really only support a party. And this is what happened yesterday. So, and we'll see what will happen on May 7, because it's still a question mark. Huh? Yes, he's definitely Emmanuel Macron, probably the potential winner. But we don't know what could happen, especially the debate, the TV debate, right, will be very interesting to watch. And and we are in a very unpredictable situation, right, to be honest.
Mr. Arias, good morning from New York City. I look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks.
Good morning,
in
Tony.
Paris. Help me here with a little bit of history, which you are expert at. If we migrate from Charles de Gaulle to Mr. Hollande, did the Fifth Republic die yesterday?
Definitely, I think it's a huge transformation. I would say that we are definitely writing a new chapter in the French politics, no question. I would say maybe yes, died, but the problem is not just to die, is now we need to build a new yeah, era, no question. So I don't know if the next president will be ready to move, to bring everyone in Versailles, where traditionally you put everyone together to write a new constitution, etc. But if we really want a deep, needed transformation of the political French system, we need to go to a new big chapter. And I think Emmanuel Macron, at least, is ready for that.
The very important statement there about a new constitution. Help me here with what Charles de Gaulle did, which was make a very strong executive branch. Would you suggest that France needs a more American-like or British-like power of the legislature? Do we need to get back to the Fourth Republic or back, just after 1848?
I don't know if we need to go back. Usually we look forward.
Yeah.
But definitely we need this change. We definitely need the change. We need to be ready for coalitions. We need to be more inclusive. We're always talking about inclusive growth. We should have a more inclusive political system. We should more talk to the private sector leaders. We should talk to the youth. We should involve more youth. We should not ignore what, as I say to Francine, these frustrated people, the 3+ million jobless, unemployed people who are really making a big change, the people who are questioning about the future of Europe, all these people need to have a voice. And this is why the system has to change. The education system in France is not appropriate anymore at all. So many transformations, many business models have to change. This is my personal conviction, at least. And this is why I'm not surprised by having Emmanuel Macron becoming what he's becoming.
But you're absolutely certain that the French people want this. Because my concern, when you look at the economics, so there are great ideas that you mentioned. When you look at the economics, one of the problems is that France manufactures things as much or as the same quality as Spain, but actually you pay for them a lot more. So there needs to be a reduction in labor. Are we going to see protests and manifestations in the street every week if he tries to get that done?
It's quite a tradition in France to have people having strikes and doing strikes. But at the same time, we need reforms. This is not negotiable. And this is what we are saying for years. We cannot continue with the system, which is totally, obsolete. No question. We organize, Francine, many international global conferences where we put together investment, foreign direct investors, political leaders, entrepreneurs, NGOs. And the real message coming all the time is, hey, guys, when France will become, again, business-friendly? When France will become attractive? So much talent exists in France. France is becoming a startup nation. But the tax system is so heavy, it has to be reformed. Well, totally. The education system is not ready for our next big challenges, robotics, artificial intelligence. These are the jobs of today and tomorrow. We are not still ready for that.
Mr. Arias, thank you so much for being with us. Joining us in our studios in New York, Julia Coronado. Wonderful to have you here. You were the chief North American economist for BNP Paribas, the large bank. Do the financial systems of Europe, do they breathe a ginormous sigh of relief this morning?
It's a pretty ginormous sigh of relief.
I agree.
Yes, absolutely.
Excuse me, ginormous is Rosetta Stone level 3, David, for French. It's a huge deal, isn't it, for BNP Paribas and SocGen and Crédit Agricole?
It definitely is. I mean, just eliminating a major tail risk, it doesn't solve all the problems or necessarily move forward some of the reforms that need to happen still in the financial sector. But just getting that tail risk off the table is quite important.
That tail risk off the table, let's look domestically now to what is a busy week in Washington. A lot of risk here. The president continuing continuing to talk about the prospects for health care reform and tax reform, all the while looking at 3 legislative days here ahead of a potential government shutdown at the end of the week. Give us your sense of the lay of the land in Washington, at least for this week ahead.
It's just yet another remarkable week ahead for us on the policy front in the U.S. I mean, I think at the end of the day, what one would expect is that they will pull themselves together and get a continuing resolution signed so that the government keeps the lights on. But there's plenty of saber rattling and brinksmanship potentially over the wall. This ambition to revive the repeal of Obamacare, the noises about tax reform. I think the tax reform is more smoke and mirrors. We're not really going to learn anything this week. I doubt that we really see a lot on the healthcare front, even if they get something through the House. There's still the Senate. It just seems like such a heavy lift. But so I think there's lots of risk. At the end of the day, I expect we get a continuing resolution signed and we move on.
And with that, is that the new normal now? Is that status quo to get continuing resolutions? In other words, how disappointing would that be to markets to have another one of these stopgap spending bills?
You know, that's hard to say. I mean, I think we haven't seen a lot of productivity out of Washington. I think the prospects for some of the more fundamental tax reform and tax overhauls with the border adjustment tax, the probabilities of that kind of reform have definitely receded. Will we get a tax cut? Probably at some point. It's hard to say what would be disappointing to markets. Markets certainly have been looking at the glass half full so far.
What have we heard from the Treasury Secretary? He spoke twice over these last few days, first at an event ahead of the IMF and the World Bank spring meetings, and then he was on stage with them, Madame Lagarde, at the IMF doing a Q&A with her. What's he projecting about this administration's economic policy at this point?
Well, of course, you know, the Treasury Secretary is going to be taking the glass half full. He's saying that they're committed to tax reform. I think there is some relief that they're not taking the harder line on things like trade policy or currency manipulation, and he seems to strike a more moderate tone there, and that's reassuring. But you know, it's a legislative labyrinth in Washington, and you really need to trade a lot of horses to get things done. There's lots and lots of vested interests. That's how we designed our political system. And both the good news and the bad news is it's really hard to get things done, which means less disruptive things are less likely to happen, but also some of the more exciting, game-changing reforms are less likely to happen.
I just want to get your sense of the headline from that conversation with Christine Lagarde. He said that an America First policy or reprioritizing America's role in the global economy is not inherently bad for the global economy. Does that make sense? I mean, is that an argument that makes sense? Sorry.
You know, I think that that's more of a headline and less of a reality. Mm. I think this idea that we're going to deglobalize is just not pragmatic. I mean, it's too good for the global economy as a whole. It's too good for business. And I think ultimately we'll get maybe some adjustments in certain trade agreements, but globalization's here to stay.
Yeah, the globalization's here to stay. We'll continue with Julia Coronado. This on a merger Monday. France election, Charles de Gaulle.
foie gras canard or whatever Francine's. Francine's having like a $200 lunch, I think.
Well, she can pronounce all the menu items.
That's true. We can't order. That's why Al from New Jersey said, you're not going. How about this, though? Becton Dickinson and C.R. Bard in New Jersey with a merger yesterday afternoon, I'll call it. And now we see an upgrade, PPG going after ExxonMobil. And to say, clearly, they will not move European factories to the United States. This is Bloomberg. Julia Coronado, help us here with some American analysis. When you look at the economy right now, do you see nominal GDP pop, which pops revenues, which works down the income statement to sustain cash flows, which means I can own stocks this morning?
Well, I'm a member of the National Association of Business Economics, and we just released our second quarter survey. And what we did see in there was an improvement in profits. That was probably the biggest headline out of the survey, and it came from increased pricing power. Now, that may not jive well with what we've seen in the consumer price index of late, but I think when we dig into the details, we can see it's really driven by the manufacturing goods producing sector, by the rebound in commodities and the global manufacturing cycle. And I think that that's filtering into U.S. bottom lines, not so much into CapEx and hiring plans. Those are sort of chugging along, but companies are seeing the profitability.
How should we regard this data from the NABE? We've had these debates about soft data and hard data.
Exactly.
What do these data tell you?
Well, so our survey is designed to be very specific. And so, you know, specific questions about sales and hiring and profitability rather than general questions about sentiment. And that means we got less of a pop in the Q1 survey. And we did see some fading in the second quarter. So I think if you kind of look into the details, what we see is a pretty solid late cycle economy, hiring, sales, profitability, all sort of close to longer run averages. So not particularly exciting, but I think, yeah, in terms of that tension between soft and hard data, the hard data seem to be saying no fireworks, positive or negative. We're just kind of cruising along at a decent pace.
Tom asked you about GDP. Let me ask you about inflation. What are inflation expectations like from those whom you surveyed?
Well, so inflation, so there is some optimism that there's some better pricing power than we've seen in the last couple of years. I think that, again, gets back to the materials and energy sectors that really got hit. So I think there is some optimism around that, but it still is a struggle. You've still got price-sensitive consumers who are still pretty cautious. So expectations are moderate. Yeah. And spending is moderate.
There has been fabulous coverage of retail. Folks, thanks. And this is, again, our team getting on the phone to people that manage Monday. It's because, you go, Colin, you got to tell me I can't have a bottle of champagne while David Gurr is waxing philosophical about the French elections. Well, there was 10 somewhere. I mean, thank you, David, for allowing me to get that Henriot champagne down yesterday. Help me here. I'll get this out. Help me here, Julia Coronado, with the death of retail. I mean, you mentioned consumers a little sluggish. I don't buy it's just Amazon. I just don't buy. I mean, I get it.
That's it isn't the dominant just Amazon. Yeah, it is a very broad-based and seismic shift in the way consumers spend money and what they spend money on. And that's really pressuring the traditional retail models. Consumers like experiences more than goods. The way they buy, the way they search, the way they connect with each other is different. And that gives rise to more opportunity for new models. But it really, really pressures the old school retailers.
I just want you to know that a wise guy like Julia Coronado, David, thinks tuition is an experience. Just so you know.
Hey, I have two kids in college, okay? Yeah, I'm very sensitive to that. I spend a lot of money, of my money on that, for sure.
Gurr has no idea what we're talking about.
How big a weight is retail right now on the economy overall, and how do we get past that?
So I think, again, it's not that the consumers aren't spending. It's the way that they're spending is different. So I think for an overall economy perspective, it's okay, but you are going to see some store closures. We've seen a lot of announcements along those lines and a big change. I think from a macro perspective, things are okay. The consumer is fine. But But, you know, there is some structural changes within the retail industry that need to happen. And that's going to mean changing employment, changing investment, and changing profitability.
Thank you for coming in today.
It's my pleasure.
And, you know, particularly earlier with Francine in Paris putting up with, you know, the wonderful logistics we have to go through.
You were very patient. Nimble.
Julia Coronado, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
With Macro Policy Perspectives. Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC. There's something new from Bloomberg. It's called Lens. Starting right now, you can use the Bloomberg iOS app off your iPhone or iPad or our new Google Chrome extension to read any news story on any website, scan it, and then instantly see the news story's relevant market data from Bloomberg. In addition, see all the bios of the key people mentioned in the story. It's called Lens, and it is just that, a lens into the people and the data of any story you may be reading. Again, Lens brings you the power of Bloomberg's news and data. Download our iOS app or search for the Bloomberg extension at the Chrome Store to try Lens out. Learn more at Bloomberg.com/Lens.
Let's get some broader perspective now on this administration, on what's happening in Washington. From David Rothkopf, he's the founder and CEO of Garton Rothkopf, the CEO and editor of the FP Group, and the author of a new book, The Great Questions of Tomorrow. He joins us on our phone lines. David Rothkopf, there is perhaps no bigger expert on the NSC than you on national security issues. So let's go there to start. We have the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, in Afghanistan on a surprise visit today. What's your sense of who's driving national security policy in this administration right now?
Well, if you can imagine a car with four or five steering wheels, I think that'd give you the best idea. I mean, the president's going in one direction, and, you know, Mattis and McMaster are sort of going in another more traditional direction. We've got still big divides between the White House and the intelligence community. State Department's off there, not with much support and not with much visibility, and Tillerson trying to get his legs out under him. And then you've got these sort of circle of people around the president who are still, you know, sort of X factors, whether it's the recently sort of demoted Bannon or some of the other folks in the White House. And then, of course, you got the Hill. So right now the message we're sending the world is we don't know where we're going and we don't know how we're going to get there.
We talk about Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, how he hasn't gotten anything close to a complement of advisors or deputy secretaries of state in Foggy Bottom right now. What is it about Secretary Mattis? He seems to have done a bit better. This is not an agency, the Defense Department, that's as beset by worry, concern, or scandal.
Well, I mean, I think part of it is Mattis has established a relationship with the president. I think also the president has seen that he gains from appearing strong with regard to the Pentagon, and I think there's some division within his advisors and within the Republican Party about the, you know, merits of a lot of the programs in the State Department. But there are a lot of senior level jobs in the Pentagon that are still unfilled, so I wouldn't suggest that, you know, they've got their arms around that one yet either. Yeah.
David, your wonderful new book, The Great Questions of Tomorrow. Folks, it's short, beautiful, hyper-focused. It's a great, abrupt read on the changes. As I mentioned earlier, the rules of the game and politics are changing. You say democracy and government reimagined. And you say it is generally a glacial embrace of modernity. The glacier's melting right now. Where are we going to be in 5 years on the establishment parties, whether it's France, the United Kingdom, or the United States?
Well, I think there's a lot of changes happening in the world, very big changes, changes that involve linking everybody together in a connected system, remaking the models of how we create a job, remaking economics, changing the nature of monetary policy, changing the nature of war, and changing the nature of peace. And the people who are most behind the curves on this are the establishment, political leaders, institutions, and so forth. And so I think what you've seen around the world is a backlash against institutions and the establishment, and also a backlash against the perceived beneficiaries of this in the elites. one of the most interesting things of the past few months is look at all these elections that have gone the way we didn't expect. In Istanbul and Ankara, they voted against Erdogan, but the rest of the country voted for him. In Moscow, they voted against Putin, but the rest of the country for him. In England, they voted against Brexit, London, the rest of the country for him. In the U.S., the big cities against Trump, the rest of the country for him.
Right. I did a panel at the World Bank here a few days ago with the ministers of Colombia, Indonesia, Turkey, and Ukraine. How alone are they? I mean, if President Trump says, make America great again, and isolationism reigns somewhat supreme, how alone are the rest of the countries?
Well, I think that's a really American kind of way of framing the question.
What's you know, there are
there are 200 countries out there, and they don't think they're alone within America. They think they're going to get along just fine. I travel around all the world all the time, and the rest of the world is like, well, this Trump guy is a clown, and he doesn't really know what he's doing. We're a little worried on this issue or that issue, but you know, we got to get up in the morning, go to our jobs, and build our countries. So if America takes a step back, other people step up, whether it's bad guys in Russia, or whether it's the government in China, or whether it's local governments, other people are filling the void. That's the issue for the United States. It's not that the world's going to fall apart without us. It's going to keep moving on.
The book begins in Summit, New Jersey. A young David Rothkopf worried about nuclear winter, your dad working at Bell Labs. You look ahead here to where we are now, and you say, who are we is an even bigger question than who am I. You describe the situation we're in as a cool war, not a cold war, but a cool war. Help us with that question, who we are, and do you think enough people are thinking in a sort of collective way about the future?
I don't. I think we're at sort of the verge of one of these once-in-500-year changes because we're within 10 years of effectively everybody on the planet being connected in a man-made system for the first time, which changes our view of identity and governance and money and war and peace and so forth. And we're focused on momentary issues. We're focused on dysfunction in Washington, or we're focused on terrorism, which is not an existential threat in any means, and we're not taking the long-term view. That's the problem for us, because essentially what's going to happen is we are going to react to massive changes after they happen, and that can be very disruptive, and history shows that. You know, when the Reformation happened and people weren't prepared, the next result was the 30 Years' War, which was the biggest war the world had ever seen. And I think what we need to do is we need to say, these changes are coming, we need to get ahead of them. We need to think about the big picture issues and try to take a step away from the headlines every once in a while.
David Rothkopf, thanks very much for joining us. That's David Rothkopf, the author of the new book, The Great Questions of Tomorrow, joining us on our phone lines.
This is a really important conversation, folks, and it's not just about France. George Friedman often writes about and is associated with the military and with the analysis of our forces, but he has a great political context as well. George Friedman joining us now. George, you have a terrific essay, The Collapse of the Left. And I really was thinking about that overnight. If I look at France, if the dominance of the socialists and what we know of Francois Mitterrand and Bieck before that, the development of the Fifth Republic, well, forget about all that mumbo jumbo. It's worldwide. And maybe it's the Democrats in the United States as well. How does the left regroup?
Well, the left regroups by going back to its roots. It was the party of the poor working class. Or the poor working class. It no longer is. It represents the technocrats who are in favor of the European Union. It has close ties to the financial community. And the right wing, in fact, has taken over that class, not only in France, but in the United States. For better or worse, it's Donald Trump who speaks for the poor white industrial class.
I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, you're with Geopolitical Futures. What's the geopolitical futures of a left respectfully suspect of capitalism?
Well, what we're really seeing here is the consequences of 2008. 2008, everybody looked at it as a banking crisis. It was also a crisis of the legitimacy of the banking elite. Were they criminals? Were they competent? Why did this thing have happened? And then the spinoffs of 2008, particularly in Europe, the catastrophic outcome in Southern Europe, where unemployment went over 20%, raised the question whether the political elite cares at all about the poor people. So you wound up with the poorer class having no representation. In came the people like Le Pen, in came Brexit, in came the whole question of the EU legitimacy and immigration and a whole bunch of other issues.
And David, what's so important about this, and I clearly remember this, is 1956. And Mr. Friedman came from Hungary with his family, and it was the tumult of being, and let me tell you, the suitcase, I remember the suitcases and the kids in school who didn't speak a word of English. Was that you, George? Were you one of the kids that didn't speak a word of school, a word of English in my school?
I didn't speak a word of English till I was 7.
Wow. Yeah. George, let me just ask you about the importance of party going forward here. I'll ask you in the context of France first. We've seen the creation of these two, or creation of the growing of these two very new parties. Let's pull back a little bit, talk about it in the U.S. as well. Do we have voters less interested and less devoted to voting by party?
Well, I think the real question is that the left and the right have become meaningless. It's very hard to tell what Trump is. It's easier to tell what the Democrats are. But from a practical point of view, the old distinction just isn't working. The parties, some will shift, they will survive, but they won't look anything like they are. The Republican Party doesn't look anything like the party of Ronald Reagan today. And that's what's really important, which is that we're in a new period. As I said before, the new period was initiated by 2008, and this is the new normal. It's not going back to the way it was.
There's been sort of a wink and a nod, as we heard from other candidates over these last 24 hours, many of them throwing their support behind Mr. Macron. What happens to the voters in France who voted for Marine Le Pen if, in fact, she doesn't win in the second round? Who carries their grievances going forward? Is this a candidate? Is Mr. Macron a candidate who can welcome them into his fold at all?
Well, this is his problem. In the same way as in the United States, the loathing for the Trump supporters are enormous, and the Trump supporters' loathing for the Democrat is enormous. Same in France. You have a huge segment of the population that is deeply dissatisfied. Macron could ignore them, but it only makes them grow because they have real problems. Or he can shift his policies away from the position he's taken elsewhere. We don't know that Macron is going to win. We had been wrong on every major election from Brexit to Trump as going in there. What is going on is a complete upheaval in how the political system works. And we have to be very careful. I mean, he may well win. We have to be careful of two things. One, whether he's going to be strong enough to simply ignore Le Pen's followers. And two, is he actually going to win? We don't know how the voters are going to break on this. We don't know they're going to follow their leaders. So it's not out of the question that she's going to have another surprise upset.
On that note, what does turnout tell you quickly from yesterday's election? We had 79% turnout. Seems pretty good.
Wow.
Seems like that portends the fact that he might do well next time around.
Well, what it really tells us is that France is unstable. When there's a low political turnout, it's not because people are alienated. It's because people are pretty content, and whoever wins, wins, and I don't care. We saw a large turnout because France has been highly politicized, because there's great tension on all sides. And that is an explosive event. High turnouts usually happen when people really care about politics.
George, let's wander away from France for a little bit. Maybe we'll wander back here in a few minutes. But let me ask you about what's been going on in East Asia. The Vice President of the United States finishing up a 10-day trip. This was like a Commonwealth tour of days of old. I mean, he's been gone for a while now, traveling with his family, visiting a number of cities in East Asia, down in Australia as well. He's in Hawaii today. But he had a message about North Korea, policy toward North Korea, that he delivered in Seoul, carried that on throughout the region. Do you have a sense at this point of what the Trump administration's policy toward North Korea is?
Well, I think it's the problem of intelligence. No one is quite sure whether or not the North Koreans have already acquired a deliverable weapon, are close to it, or are bluffing. If they've come close to delivering, having one, if they actually do have one, the United States is going to face a very serious pressure. Allies like Japan are going to be in range. We assume that the North Koreans aren't crazy, but we can't bet on it. We may have to carry out airstrikes. Right now, Trump has made it very clear in a tweet. If the Chinese help them out, he'll lighten up on trade issues. Now, this is something that's always been done. This is the first time we've seen a president actually admit he's doing it. So what's going on right now is a lot of bargaining with the Chinese. And the question is whether the Chinese have control. And I think they do.
Yeah, I mean, he gets into this in great detail in an interview with the AP that was done on Friday, I believe. He really talks about the kind of deal-making he's intending to do with the Chinese. Do we have more economic options at our disposal when you look in that toolkit of sanctions? Is anything left in there?
Well, I'll be very cynical. I think every time the Chinese get into problems with the United States on trade, the North Koreans do something outrageous. When they do something outrageous, the United States winds up turning to the Chinese looking for help. When that happens, the Chinese come back to the Americans and say, hey, we just bailed you out of North Korea. Why are you complaining about trade right now? So I think the Chinese have been playing this game with us for a while.
What do you make of the relationship here the president seems to be developing with the Chinese president? He spoke with him by phone yesterday, the White House giving a short readout of that phone call, saying they continue to have conversations about the relationship. Are you optimistic that it's going to lead to sane, continued dialogue between these two countries?
Well, we've always had dialogue. I'm not sure what we call sane, which is being very accommodating, has always been very effective. I think one of Trump's advantages is he scares people. And in negotiating, scaring people sometimes gets you what you need. So one of the dangers of the Trump administration is he becomes like the Obama administration in a lot of these things. Obama was a very reasonable guy.
George, help me here with the Frankfurt School, of which you're associated. And it's a very careful long-term
Good Lord.
About now, come on, help me here with the fitting in of a political theory and our new politics. Are any of the people that we're talking about, do they have anything to do with modern capitalism or the questions of modern capitalism that the Frankfurt School brought up decades ago? Or are these guys, Trump, these guys, Prime Minister May, these guys, Angela Merkel, maybe she's the traditionalist in the group, or maybe the newly minted president of France, if we get it. Are any of these people prepared for this linkage of capitalism with the doubts about capitalism?
Well, this went way back in my past. I wrote a book on this when I was a kid. Look, the new left's critique of capitalism was that it was successful but corrupt, that you lived in ticky-tacky little houses, your soul was given over to making money, and so on. We actually have a much more traditional problem going on, which is poverty. So they criticize the industrial working class for selling out. The problem we have now has a little more to do with the time before FDR came in, where the industrial working class, a huge swath of industrial society around the world, have really lost their basis. If you're in the lower middle class, where I grew up, you're now taking home perhaps $2,000, $3,000 a month. You're not buying a house. You're not doing the basic things the American dream is supposed to give you. So I would argue that the new left has been superseded by an old reality, class distinctions.
This is a huge deal, David. I mean, it's way too deep for Monday morning. This is something we bury George with.
I almost fainted when you brought it up.
Well, come on. But, I mean, folks, I just put out on Twitter Megan Desai's classic Marx's Revenge, which addresses the Frankfurt School and others. But, I mean, look at the David, what you covered with Francine yesterday. It's almost a world. It is a world turned upside down. There's no other way to put it.
Yeah, and George, what's the legacy of that? How does this continue going forward? We look ahead to the second round in France, but what are you looking to next? What event to tell you about the direction we're going in?
Well, we're now in a long process. The critical event, as I said, was 2008. We're playing out the game. The Financial Times continues to think that if the banking system is healthy, high unemployment is not a problem. What you have here is a large class of people who are now being excluded from the political system, and they are coming back and pushing back. What we're going to see is more aggressive activity. If it turns out that Macron and others ignore them. It's going to be, you're going to wind up with violence. This is a serious situation. These people are hurting. And the sense is that the elite doesn't care.
Very quickly here, George Freeman, to circle back to David Gura's first question to you, can the Le Pen people show up as the left does not vote for Mr. Macron?
Well, I think what's going to happen is the left is not going to vote for him simply because he's, simply committed.
Oh, come on. He's a Rothschild banker. He has nothing to do with the left, right?
He has nothing to do with the left. He is completely committed to the EU. This is a campaign between that group, which feels that the EU has failed and that capitalism is failing, mm-hmm. and that group that's saying, hey, it's just fine. There's no problem.
Right.
And they may still have a majority in France. But I'm not certain that this election is going to wind up with him as president.
Right. George Friedman, thank you. Never enough time, as always. Geopolitical Futures. John Tucker, there'll be a pop quiz at 10:05 this morning on the Frankfurt School.
Not open book. Yeah. Not open.
Mr. Habermas right. and all the others.
I would highly actually recommend DeSai's book.
Yeah, this is a different book than the one you read. Marxist Revenge is a Bible. It's absolutely fabulous. Anyways, George Friedman this morning. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.